I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Growing up, Danny Shapiro was constantly told, "You don't look Jewish." A family friend, a Holocaust survivor, even said, "We could have used you in the ghetto, little blondie. You could have gotten us bread from the Nazis." Shapiro was blonde with blue eyes and looked nothing like the rest of her family. In fact, she always felt like an outsider, that she didn't quite belong in her family. A spur-of-the-moment decision to spit into a vial and have her DNA analyzed changed her life. It turns out the man she called Dad was not her biological father. That secret and the shock of realizing that who and what she called family did not tell the whole story sent her on a sleuthing mission to find her biological father. It didn't take long. Danny Shapiro's new memoir, Inheritance, is about what happened at a Philadelphia fertility clinic more than 50 years ago, her search for her biological father, her thoughts on what we mean by family and identity, and how new fertility technologies are taking us into uncharted territory. Danny Shapiro joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. You've given us a lot to talk about. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This is your fifth memoir. You've written four memoirs before this. And what I found so interesting is that I think for all of us, and maybe for you in particular, that this quest to understand our family, ourselves, our lives, is really a lifelong quest. For you, there was this moment of realization that this man that you called Dad was not your biological father. But in many ways, I identified with your quest to understand who you are and where you came from.
Well, exactly. And for me, it's very interesting now to think, why was I writing so many memoirs? I mean, I began as a novelist. I wrote three novels, and then I started writing memoirs, and I kind of never stopped. And it was almost like I was digging and digging and digging for something that I didn't know I was digging for. But there was absolutely a sense that there was a secret. In the book I write, I always felt there was a secret. What I didn't know, the secret was me. And so that all led to this moment. I mean, in a way, one of the reviews that came out recently said, Danny Shapiro is both the worst person and the best person for this to have happened.
Exactly.
Because I have been digging all my life.
Exactly. And this was a kind of a spontaneous moment. Your husband said, you know, basically turned to you and said, spit into this vial and let's see what happens.
Yeah,
he gave it no further thought.
My husband was interested in doing it for himself, just kind of recreational genealogy, something that he could talk about with his elderly parents. And he asked me if I wanted to do it too. I so easily could have said no. And then I just would have spent my whole life not knowing. I'm very glad I do.
You're very glad you do know.
I'm very glad I do know.
It's interesting, when the results came back, they kind of sat around for a bit. And then at some point, when you began to really look at the material or the information and your husband was pointing things out to you, you realized, oh my God.
Yeah, it was a slow process, and I think there was a certain amount of denial on my part, because it had never occurred to me that my dad wasn't my biological father, despite the fact that there were clues to that. My parents were much older. I was an only child. I did look so different from my family, and I looked very particularly like I came from a different part of the world than they did. But that just seemed to me like an anomaly. Right. It was just kind of a strange, weird thing about me. And was the story of my life, that every day I was told that. But so that beginning of a sense of, okay, wait a minute, this is showing that I'm 52% Eastern European Ashkenazi, and the rest is this smattering of Western European countries, you know, French, Irish, English, German, Swedish. But still, I thought, well, maybe all Jews are 50% Jewish, you know.
Sure.
And then the next thing that happened was that a first cousin appeared on my page on Ancestry.com, and it was a complete stranger to me. I knew all my first cousins, and here was this first cousin who had unfamiliar initials, and his page was managed by someone who had a name. So I had a couple of clues right away, but there was this feeling of this slow dawning realization, and my husband, who was way further ahead of me in the lack of denial, because it was easier for him. For me, it was a very dangerous thought. My father wasn't my biological father after 54 years. What do you do with that? So I do have a half-sister, much older than I am, who was from a previous marriage, a very early marriage of my father's when he was a much younger man. And I wrote to her because I recalled that she had told me once that she had done DNA testing. And I asked her if she had her results, and she did. And there is a way, there's something called GEDmatch, where you can compare two kits to see how closely you're related. And that was the moment my life changed, because she sent her results, we compared the two kits, and we were not sisters.
I'm trying to imagine that moment. I think you describe it as traumatic discovery. I mean, this realization that this person that you had called father, your dad, your whole life, really was not your biological father. But I also got the feeling that it explained a lot of things to you about your family.
Yeah, it really did both. And I also want to stress that it wasn't only the sense or the realization that my father wasn't my biological father, but that my ancestors, who I was very connected to and who I had written about a lot and whose portraits hung on the wall of my house, I was very enamored of my ancestors on my father's side. In the book, I describe them as a family very conscious of their own posterity and kind of a magical bunch of people mm-hmm. that I felt proud to be connected to. And suddenly, I wasn't. So that was this kind of profound loss. It was like losing an entire half of me in some way. It was a rootlessness. You know, we use that phrase very easily, the rug is pulled out from under me, and we never think of what it actually means, but that's what that felt like. Right. It felt completely groundless. And yet at the same time, very quickly, and then over the course of the last couple of years, it was like putting on a pair of 3D glasses yeah. and suddenly being able to see all the dimensions and all the colors and, oh, that makes so much sense now. The narratives that I had always told myself about my family and that I had written about in book and after book, all of those narratives were still true. Mm-hmm. Reasons why my mother was the way she was, why my dad was the way he was, why their marriage was contentious, why I felt the way I did, all of that was still true, but it wasn't the whole truth. And all of a sudden, the whole truth was presented to me and I could hold it in my hands for the first time.
Like a kind of Rosetta Stone in a way, sort yeah. of explaining things that perhaps didn't make sense or just had been hanging out there.
Yeah, it's very liberating ultimately to be able to make that kind of sense. It wasn't liberating right away. It was destabilizing and shocking and it was traumatic. But ultimately, I remember a friend of mine saying early on to me, when you get to the other side of this, you will be free. And I remember thinking, she said, when you get to the other side, not if you get to the other side. And I thought, well, if I get to the other side. But I knew that what she was saying was true, that there would be freedom if I could get there.
I'd love to have you read the very first paragraph to your memoir. It's called Inheritance, just to address what it is we have just been talking about.
When I was a girl, I would sneak down the hall late at night once my parents were asleep. I would lock myself in the bathroom, climb onto the formica counter, and get as close as possible to the mirror until I was nose to nose with my own reflection. This wasn't an exercise in the simple self-absorption of childhood. The stakes felt high. Who knows how long I kneeled there, staring into my own eyes. I was looking for something I couldn't possibly have articulated, but I always knew it when I saw it. If I waited long enough, my face would begin to morph. I was 8, 10, 13. Cheeks, eyes, chin, and forehead, my features softened and shape-shifted until finally I was able to see another face, a different face, what seemed to me a truer face just beneath my own.
You describe this sense of not just not belonging to your family or feeling somehow different. I mean, obviously you look different, but this longing for something else, for maybe even a different family.
You know, there's a phrase I came across in my research, and it's been used mostly in literature about adoption, but it applies here as well very much, which is genealogical bewilderment. I found that such a powerful idea, the sense of being bewildered in some way that was largely not conscious. Where one comes from, that I think was something that was really happening to me, but I didn't realize it.
Do you think there was something in the family? I mean, this was a secret, but I wonder whether did your parents know? And they came to Philadelphia to this fertility clinic, which I do want to talk about, but did they know about the sort of mixing of genes between your dad's sperm and also a donor sperm so that somehow this mixing created you?
Yeah, so much of the research that I began to do within moments of my discovery had to do with trying to get as close as I possibly could to the room where it happened, trying to understand what my parents actually would have been through. Because at first I really thought, they must not have known this. Right. There is no way that we could have lived our shared life together with them keeping such a massive secret from me. But I was very quickly disabused of that notion. There wasn't a single expert or anyone I talked to or any elderly person who might have known something that I spoke to, no one would get on board with me for that theory. And what I came to really understand about that time is my parents. So this institute was called the Farris Institute for Parenthood. It was on
affiliated with Penn.
It was on the campus of Penn. Dr. Edmund Farris was known for his use of donor sperm. I was told by an elderly woman I recently spoke with who conceived her children there that there was no way a couple going there would not have known what they were there for. However, so discussions would be had. Blood type would be discussed. Trying to match traits of the father would be discussed. But after that, the Institute would do absolutely everything possible to allow the couple to forget that this had happened. Hmm. They would mix donor sperm with the father's sperm, but the couple would be told to go home and have sex, come in and do the procedure, go home and have sex again. That way you'll never really know. The child will never be told. The obstetrician delivering the child won't know this, so the birth certificate can actually be a false document but not done under any kind of, you know, pretenses. And also they would be told, the wife, when she would become pregnant, would often be told, this is so interesting, you must have already been pregnant when you came in. That's what the timing is showing. So depending on where on the scale you fell of how much of a realist you were, it was possible to completely explode this into microscopic bits and make it go away because no one was ever going to know. It was going to be a secret that went to the grave with everybody.
And the donors were medical students at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Farris, you quote him in the book, or there was an article where he says, "I see nothing wrong in trying to bring children of fine quality into the world." He described the donors in his institute as the best material that Philadelphia medical schools can offer. You're shaking your head.
It was so chilling when I read that. I had to read the research and papers and books around that time. It was like looking at the sun for me. I could read about three sentences at a time before I would start to kind of be triggered completely by it. Because what are we talking about there? That's eugenics. That's what it is. And
like, you know, a master race in a way.
In a way, you know, there was a list in another book that I read of traits that would be optimal traits in a donor, and it was things like free of any hereditary taints or must be men of science and medicine, of sound character, of fine physical stock. Yeah, I mean, what else but, you know, kind of eugenic thinking? There was, you know, it's easy for us now in the present day to understand how complicated and strange and unethical in various ways that was. But back then, this was the Wild West of reproductive medicine, and the child was the prize. The child was the end result.
Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our guest. That's Dani Shapiro. We're talking about her new book. It's titled Inheritance, a Memoir of Genealogy, Paternity, and Love. You can join us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Dani Shapiro. She took a genetic test on a whim a couple of years ago, thinking that she knew her history, her family history well, but this DNA sample revealed that her dad really wasn't her biological father. She's written four previous memoirs. She's got this new one, Inheritance, and she writes about how this shocking revelation changed and explained some of her identity, some of her family secrets, and raises a whole host of questions about paternity and identity and some of this new technology. And again, you can join us 1-888-477-9499. Let me just read a couple of Facebook comments. I put something yesterday on our Facebook page. Shani says, "I'm an adoptee who found my biological mother in adulthood and used 23andMe after she passed away to get a better sense of some health questions. I learned that the person I thought was my biological father most likely isn't. It's my own personal mystery." I'm sure something you can relate to. A Facebook comment from Linda. I did Ancestry.com and found my paternal grandfather's lineage. I was able to connect names and snippets that my dad shared, and I have connected with a new wing of my family. So obviously this goes in many different directions. Let me go back to the 1960s and also back to Philadelphia. As you said, this was a kind of wild west of fertility clinics. Was there kind of a shame, you think, that couples had that they had to seek treatment in order to get pregnant?
Yeah, I think where there are secrets, there's almost always underlying shame, whatever the secret is. And in the 50s and 60s and beyond, I think that infertility, particularly male infertility, was seen as really shameful and traumatic. Childlessness was really like pretty much not an option. The culture was such that, you know, I think it was either Time or Newsweek had a survey in which 0% of Americans believed that zero children was the right number for a family.
Oh, interesting.
You know, Edward Albee's eviscerating play, you know, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, was about to open on Broadway. That was a portrayal of a childless couple. So, yeah, there was tremendous shame and tremendous secrecy around it. And there could be secrecy around it. The idea of a future in which DNA, which had only been discovered a decade earlier, that where there would be a future in which you could spit into a plastic vial and there would be this, you know, thing called the internet where you could find out everything about everything at any time, and that this would not be just sealed away in this completely. I mean, one of the things I really learned about secrets in general is that if you are told that something will be a secret no matter what, it can't ever be discovered, it's actually possible to pretty much put it aside or put it on a shelf deep, deep, you know, into the unconscious and feel like it never even happened, which I think is what a lot of the parents did, and also a lot of what the donors themselves did, because they were guaranteed anonymity.
Well, it's interesting, some of this language back in the 60s, artificial bastards, confused artificial insemination. I mean, even the language is so damning in so many ways.
Yeah, I mean, that was initially, as I started wading into it, you know, newspaper headlines were things like test tube tots. And there was something that was so science fiction-y and strange and, you know, just I wanted no part of it when I first made the discovery, and have since come to feel very differently about that. But yeah, very, very complicated, damning language.
You say this obviously takes you on a journey to your childhood and to your parents and your relationship with them. But it sounds like in many ways you were more connected to your father than your mother. And in many ways you felt like maybe my mother isn't my mother.
Yeah, that was a great
A lot of
irony.
Daughters feel that way at times. But nonetheless, it seemed like that was a very powerful emotion that you had about her.
Yes. I mean, when I first made the discovery, I think one of the things that was so upsetting to me about it was that I had entertained the childhood fantasy that my mother wasn't my mother, even though I couldn't quite figure out biologically how that would have worked.
Yes, of course.
But I had somehow managed to feel that I was even more my father's daughter than my mother's, something I actually still feel is true, yeah, but not biologically. And so that discovery, those initial hours and days of feeling like, wait a minute, I am biologically my mother's child, and I'm not biologically my father's child, and my biological father is a sperm donor somewhere out there in the world that I may never know anything about or be able to encounter. That was the feeling again of the rug being pulled out.
Sure.
Of just, well, who am I if I don't know who I am? Mostly because I had spent 54 years in the certainty that I knew.
Well, and you, this question seemed to really gnaw at you, that did your mother deceive your father about whether he was the father or not? That was something that just seemed to, you wanted to get the answer to that question.
I really did. I really did. At one point, I went to see an elderly rabbi who my parents, my father in particular, had known well. And the rabbi said to me, "You'll never know." And I remember thinking, "You don't know who you're dealing with." He also said to me, "Which story would ease your heart?" Which was a lovely rabbinical thing to say. But my response was, "The true one." I was after the truth, after a lifetime of not knowing the truth. So my journey really moved from my parents knew nothing, they were fooled, nobody got on board with that, to My mother must have deceived my father. That would have been in her character. She would have been capable of doing that. But nobody would really get on board with that either.
Right.
It really seemed that parents went and they signed a piece of paper. But also beyond signing a piece of paper, beyond that kind of absolute, you know, sort of transparency, there was also the matter of the fact that they went to an institute known for donor sperm and that I was born and looked nothing like my dad or his family. And I grew up in this way. So when I was, I write this in the book, but when I was 3 years old, I was the Kodak Christmas poster child.
I was wishing, Grand Central Station,
in,
right?
And in F.A.O. Schwartz and all over the country, wishing the entire world a Merry Christmas. I to this day, I will never, ever be able to get to the bottom now of why my father would have been okay with that happening. I really, because in the way, in my growing up, it was just a source of amusement. Isn't this hilarious? There's this Orthodox Jewish girl who's wishing the whole world a Merry Christmas. But once you actually know the truth, which is that that little girl is, you know, half Irish and English and French and, you know, has ancestors that came over to this country, in fact, on the Mayflower, it's a little less funny and makes a little bit more sense. So I think that my father, as I was growing up, you know, the way that kids start looking more like one parent or the other, they keep on morphing. My son looked exactly like me when he was little. And then when he became a teenager, he started looking like his dad. That never happened with me. I just started looking more and more and more other, more and more like something else. So I believe that my dad knew. I believe that he deeply suspected. And I believe that he adored me, but also that it was a source of sorrow for him.
Part of your subtitle is love.
Yes.
I mean, that your dad loved you.
Oh, my dad loved me, and I loved him, and I think that's why I'm sitting here.
Oh, interesting. And I'm just flipping here because this book is for my father.
Yeah.
In a sense, you have two fathers.
Yes, but I
you
very—
didn't use a plural.
I didn't use a plural. I very much dedicated the book to my father who raised me.
Who raised you.
Yes.
Which does raise this question about, you know, who is in a sense, the real parent? Is it the parent who gives you your DNA, or is it the parent who's there when you have a fever and you skin your knee and you get an F in biology and the one who's there day to day?
Yeah, when I met my biological father, which I know we're jumping forward
That's
in time,
okay.
And it's not really a spoiler because the book's not about what happens, it's about why and how. But when I met him, the feeling that I had about him was that he was very familiar to me, that that expression cut from the same cloth, I felt that. I understood things about myself for the first time that hadn't added up and that didn't make sense. And later, the language that came to me, because I really think in language, is that he was like the country that I was from.
Hmm.
I had never visited that country. I hadn't eaten its food. I hadn't felt its temperature on my skin. I didn't know its language, but I was from there. That goes back to the genealogical bewilderment that I was talking about before.
Sure.
I felt like I had seen and met and knew the country that I was from. However, he didn't feel like my father.
Right.
And I realized that only by meeting him, that it wasn't like, oh, daddy, you know, there was nothing like that. And it made my relationship with my father, who's been gone many years, even more profound. I end up feeling that I come from three people, which is just the strange but true story of my life. My mother, who really found the Farris Institute, which was a renegade place and very much the Wild West, but had success. She found them and she convinced my father, and he went and did something that I think really wasn't easy for him.
He was Orthodox Jew, right?
Orthodox Jew, and at the time, the reading that I did around the Orthodox thinking, actually every religion, the Roman Catholic Church, I mean, it was considered an abomination. And so he would have been going against what would have been prevailing Orthodox wisdom by moving forward in this way.
And yet he did.
And yet he did. And then my biological father, who I come from in the sense that really a lot of who I am constitutionally really does come from him. I just never understood. My mother-in-law years ago said to me once, sweetheart, you must have a hell of a constitution, because she knew a lot about where I came from and my parents were, it was challenging.
Right.
And I remember thinking, she's right. I do. Why? Mm-hmm. And now I know.
And now you know. It's interesting. You saw, I believe, a video of your biological father, or something YouTube or something like that, and your husband saw it as well. But there were these subtle gestures, certain things that you did. I think you both loved the same book. Just crazy kind of coincidences there.
Yeah,
or maybe not. Coincidences.
Or maybe not coincidences. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when I first saw him. After I was able to identify him in the span of 36 hours, the first time I laid eyes on him was on a YouTube video. He is a retired physician and has a specialty in medical ethics, and he was delivering a lecture. And I mean, I could hardly take anything in. I mean, on some surreal level, I noticed that I looked an awful lot like him. But it was much, what really registered for me was the way he was moving his hands. Was the way I move my hands. I'm moving my hands that way right now.
Say, yeah, you're moving your hands
yeah.
right now. Right?
Yeah, and I recognize that. And also, I am often in my work behind a lectern and leading a Q&A, which is what he was doing at a certain point in this video. And I think the first thing I said aloud was, my God, he even runs a Q&A the way that I do. Like, where does that come from?
Right,
I mean,
what, exactly.
Where, genes are a very complex thing. And I think the one of the most interesting things to me in the process, and I think something that up until this day persists in the world of reproductive medicine, is the desire to simplify something that is actually really complex. It's a wonderful thing that there's, you know, all sorts of different ways that all different kinds of couples can make families. It's wonderful. It just also is complex. And to not register that and kind of have that be part of the conversation, I think, isn't wise ultimately and doesn't serve the child.
I'd love to have you read the letter that you wrote to your biological father. In the meantime, let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Dani Shapiro. And again, she's written a new book. It's her fifth memoir. It's titled Inheritance, A Memoir of Genealogy, Paternity, and Love. And it's about realizing that the person that she grew up with, who she called dad, was not her biological father.
Dear Dr. Walden, I'm writing to you about something that may come as a shock. My name is Dani Shapiro, and I am a 54-year-old novelist, memoirist, wife, and mother of a 17-year-old son. I live in Litchfield County, Connecticut. I recently took a DNA test as nothing more than a lark. I have always believed my parents to be my biological parents. But now I have reason to believe that you may be my biological father. I won't write more unless, A, this makes sense to you, and B, you're willing to communicate with me about it. I so hope you're willing. I'm going to send you a link to my website so you can see something of who I am. Thank you, Dani.
Hard email or hard letter to write?
Well, you know, I was told, it's very quickly, I was told that there are templates for this sort of thing, and the thought that I had was, first of all, that I've left the world of templates. I was in
You're a writer, right?
I was in my own Wild West at that moment. And I'm a writer. And I know how to craft a careful email. I wrote it very quickly. It actually wasn't hard to write at all. But I was putting myself in his shoes, which is something that I've heard any number of stories of people who find themselves in the situation who don't put themselves in the shoes of the elderly person who's about to get the shock of their life. And you know, I wanted him to know that I came in peace, that I didn't want anything from him. One of the things that, when I included the website, it was my way of saying, here, take a look at me. First of all, I look just like you. Second of all, I have a successful life. I have a career. I have a family of my own. I'm not after anything. There's no reason to be afraid of me. On the other hand, what I hadn't considered, and he and I have spoken about this later, is that on the homepage of my website, there's a picture of me with Oprah with her arm around me. And, you know, if you dig into what I do a little bit, what you discover is that I have been writing all my life about family secrets and about my family and trying to understand where I come from. So he would have been, I think, like, yay, oh, uh-oh.
Here she comes. Well, interestingly, and again, I don't think this is giving too much away. He does. He's a little reluctant at first, and I think completely understandably so. And eventually you do meet. You meet for a lunch, and you see him. It's your husband and his wife, the four of you together. And he does give you a hug.
Yes. I mean, this is...
Did that surprise you?
No.
How do you do this, right?
Yeah, how do you do this? I mean, there's no playbook for it. When my husband and I were on our way to the lunch, I was asking him questions like, do I shake his hand? Do I hug him? Who picks up the check? What do we do?
You picked up the check, right?
Who picked up the... I don't remember, actually. I think we split it. I don't remember. Maybe we did. But that was the feeling, was just... And I'm sure that he and his wife were also having that feeling of, what's this going to be like? I mean, it's a very, very strange and nervous-making thing. But the nervousness went away pretty much instantly. Mm. We liked each other. We just liked each other. And that was, that was a wonderful thing. And the lunch ended up being a 4.5-hour lunch.
Wow. And you have we should say to our listeners, that is not his name. You have covered up his identity. How would you describe your relationship with him now? How do you see each other? How do you see him?
I see him as my biological father, and that's the way that I always describe him. We have a really lovely friendship, I would say. But you know, this is a story where from the beginning, everyone tried to do the right thing all the way along. You know, the question of who owes who what in a scenario like this, which is, you know, ethically really fascinating. I felt that I owed him privacy. Right. And ultimately, I think he felt that he wanted, I mean, very early on, he offered me medical history. I'd like to point out that I had been giving incorrect medical history for my entire life, for myself, and for my son. And it's one thing to not know your medical history, like adoptees who don't know their medical history of their biological parents, or people who are donor-conceived who know that, who've never been able to find their biological father. If you don't know your medical history and you know that there's a blank there, that's one thing. But I confidently was giving history that actually just wasn't mine. And so as a doctor and as a medical ethicist himself, I think his second email to me was, you might want to know some of these things.
Let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversations. Again, Danny Shapiro, our guest. Her book is called Inheritance, A Memoir of Genealogy, Paternity, and Love. We got a lot of comments here. I will read them after the short break. RadioTimes@WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us much more after the short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with writer and memoirist Danny Shapiro. Her novels include Black and White and Family History. She's got 5 memoirs, Hourglass, Still Writing, Devotion, Slow Motion, and her new one, which we've been talking about, called Inheritance. Let me read a couple of comments here. One from Marcy. My husband and his twin sister were adopted at 6 years old. We recently found his mother's family after an ancestry DNA test we had done for our daughter. Love listening to this commentary. There's a lot of this going on, which we'll talk about. A comment from Ellen. My non-biological father felt a serious burden when my mom went to a sperm bank. And a comment from Jerry. I was in medical school and volunteered at a sperm bank because I wanted to help people. This can be a good thing for people. I mean, this is tapping into essentially where your book goes, which is wrestling with these important questions.
Absolutely. And I think regarding Jerry's comment that very much, you know, so many of the donors, especially at that time, were medical students, right, or men of science, in part because they understood, you know, that they were helping. I will say donor is a slight misnomer because there was an exchange of money involved, but they absolutely believed and were helping couples have a family, and they were also guaranteed anonymity. And I think that's one of the things that brings us all the way into the present, because there is still, in this country, a significant portion of sperm donation that is considered anonymous. If you go on any of the big sites, in my book I talk about the California Cryobank, you know, these large cryobanks, you will see listed many, many, many donors who choose not to be open donors. They wish to be anonymous. The thing about that is that's over in 2019.
You can't be anonymous.
There is no anonymity because of this incredible 1-2 punch of this easy, accessible, popular DNA testing. You know, these kits are literally the most popular holiday gift now. Families are giving it to each other. You know, they're basically stocking stuffers of, you know, look, let's all do the family who does their DNA together stays together. And so many people are doing it. And I mean, the statistic last year was that just on Ancestry.com alone, 7 million kits were sold. Right. And 14% of the people that those kits, who did those kits, discovered what's called an NPE, a not parent expected situation.
14%.
14% of 7 million people on just one site alone. So people are finding this out right and left. But in terms of anonymity, any child born today is going to be able to at some point if they wish to, and most people do wish to know something about their biology, whether they think it's psychologically significant or emotionally significant or not. I think that there is always or very often some sense of wanting to know, even if it's just medical, or longing, a sense of just wanting to understand where one's from. They're going to be contacting donors who checked the anonymous box, who don't wish to be contacted. And what that does is it sets up what is already a really complex way of coming into the world, creates rejection on top of that. So I'm actually a big believer that there shouldn't be anonymous donation anymore.
You're saying that a, what do we call it, donor child has the right to know who the donor is and something about their medical condition or their past?
Yeah, I mean, what it really boiled down to for me when I finally had this kind of clear thought, which is if biology is important enough to a family to want to go the route of donor conception so that there can be a biological connection with one of the parents, if biology is that important, then the child has a right to it too. And this is where it's the child's rights, but really the child in this scenario is often just considered the goal. And then once the child is born, then it's preferable to forget how the child got here and just we all move on. But it's not that simple. I mean, it's so wonderful that these technologies exist, but it's not simple.
Well, is it for health reasons or even the thought that biological siblings could end up marrying each other because they wouldn't know their biology?
Well, that's the other thing. And that's we and Canada are the only two countries in the developed world that do not have a registry in which there is a limit to the number of offspring that a donor can have. No limit, no registry in this country. So if you think about that,
there could be a lot of offspring from one person.
Oh,
right?
There are often, I mean, there are people who are discovering 70 half siblings, 30 half siblings. I recently just heard an anecdote somebody told me where a father sat down with his teenage kids. He had been a sperm donor in medical school. And he said, listen, like, don't go to Michigan. Just don't go to Michigan. Don't fall in love with anybody from Michigan because I donated. I donated to get through medical school. I was a poor medical student. And there are going to be a lot of people in Michigan that you don't. But meanwhile, that's as if people didn't leave Michigan.
Of course.
Right. And also, this because of frozen sperm, it's shipped all over the world. So it's kind of essential that there be record of this and for obvious reasons.
Let me read some more. Here's a question from Mary. She says, I have a 33-year-old daughter and haven't told her that her biological father was a sperm donor. When does your guest think it's the right time to tell her? Or maybe the other question should be, you know, how? I mean, you seem to be saying that children from sperm donors should know how they came to be.
Yeah, here's where it's so complex, Mary, and I really appreciate that question because when your daughter was born, or earlier than that, when I was born, there wasn't a community. There wasn't a sense of there's so many other people in the world who were born the same way I was. And there also wasn't a way of discovering anything about the biological father. That is no longer true today. Today, as far as I'm concerned, there is no excuse for not telling a child from the minute the child is conscious from very early on. There are children's books written about this with trees and acorns and branches and roots and all sorts of ways of letting really young kids understand and communities for those kids. And that is a beautiful and fantastic thing. It didn't exist when your daughter was a child. It didn't exist when I was a child. And even though I feel betrayed that I didn't know and that my paternity had was kept a secret from me, I don't know what would have happened to me if I had learned as a child. Because I wouldn't have known anyone else like me, and I already felt like a unicorn. So, and I would have had no recourse for finding my biological father or the hope of ever finding him because none of this crazy internet and DNA testing had happened. So I would say you have a 33-year-old daughter. Probably now is a good time. Because she will find out.
Because she will find out. And in many ways, your book is about a number of things, but it is about secrets. I mean, all families have secrets. They're all things that children don't know either about or from their parents. But this seems like a kind of essential secret.
Yeah, and I think the era of secrecy is ending. That's what Me Too is about. That's what this is about. There is going to be a time a couple of decades from now where the thought that we human beings ever kept secrets from each other is going to seem ludicrous because it's simply not going to be possible anymore. And just because something isn't spoken doesn't mean it doesn't exist and doesn't mean that it's not permeating the air around that secret. It's always there festering and shining light on it, even though that might be really uncomfortable at first, is, I think, the best thing we can do as human beings for each other.
This is a personal question, but as you describe, and I read some of the reviews of your previous memoirs, I mean, it's pretty clear your parents who raised you didn't have a happy marriage. There were serious problems. Your mother seemed to have some psychological problems. Your dad was sad or depressed and some conflicts over religion as well. But do you think – and you write in your book that you felt trapped on the other side of an invisible wall, separate, alone, cut off, and worst of all, not knowing why. Do you think if they had had a happier or even happy marriage, this would have been the same story?
No, but I think if you change one element of the story, the whole story changes. Because I think now, in retrospect, that one of the reasons why their marriage was unhappy, you know, I've written before in previous of my books that my mother was somewhat contemptuous of my father. And my father was somewhat passive and withdrawn. And all of the reasons that I wrote about in previous books, they're all still true, but they weren't the whole truth.
Right.
My mother's contemptuousness of my father actually is something that I understand differently now, and my father's withdrawal is also something that I understand differently now. And so, yeah, it was a kind of a parched and unhappy and very kind of sterile existence in certain ways. But I think it was all of a piece.
The contempt being you couldn't get me pregnant?
I hate to say it, but yeah.
I mean, that sounds harsh to say.
Yeah, and a kind of even though I think she buried that, even though I think that my mother spent her life managing to believe that I was my father's child, but she had to work overtime in order to really believe that. I wrote that I think my mother could have passed a polygraph. I think it was on that level that she believed that I was my father's child. When my son was born, my mother walked into the hospital room, the same hospital where she had given birth to me 37 years earlier, and said, "He looks just like a Shapiro.
Yeah.
He has the Shapiro forehead. He has the Shapiro chin." And I believe that she absolutely meant that. But I think she resented my father for having to work, that she had to work that hard to live in a state of denial of the truth.
Let me read some more comments. An email from Shelton. "My sister and I recently found out our father's father was not who we were told. We always thought we were a white family with some Native American blood. Turns out through DNA we're 25% Southeast Asian, and judging by those we are connected to on DNA testing sites, Filipino. Our father is a conservative religious man, and we did not anticipate he would want to discuss this with us. We, however, would like to know the truth. What advice do you have for us?" And this is like, how do you have this conversation?
Yeah. And so I'm gathering from the question that the father is still living.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, that's so complicated. And I've thought about that a lot, and I've wondered what I would have done if my father was still living, which, of course, would have made it a completely different story again. You know, one of the things that you're describing and that's so interesting about this question is that it's also about ethnicity and identity on, you know, on multiple levels. that is such a personal choice, and it has so much to do with what the relationship is. I mean, I heard a story recently of someone who in her case, discovered that her father wasn't her biological father and is pretty sure that he didn't know that.
Right.
And he's elderly, and she said, you know, I'm not going to tell him. It'll break him, and I'm just not going to tell him. So it has to do with what the relationship is and what the psychological makeup is of the person. Is this someone who would want to know the truth of himself? You can get to the bottom of this without talking to your father about it. The DNA that you were able to discover and the relatives you were able to discover, if you want to know more, you'll be able to know more. So the telling of him is not what's going to unleash all that information. That's a matter of whether you think he would want to know or not.
And the fact that you've got a sibling you can share it with, I mean, that seems to that might make it easier to go on this quest.
Absolutely.
And Eric from a comment from Eric. He says, I'm also a sperm donor, but I don't want to get DNA testing because my family is my family, and I don't want people coming out of the woodwork. What I hear you saying, Danny, is too late for that, right?
Yeah, it doesn't really matter whether you do DNA testing or not. And, you know, my biological father did not do DNA testing, but a nephew of his did. And that is how I found him. So that's the way in which, you know, I'm sorry to say, the era of secrecy is over. And one of the things that's happening is that people who donated are simply having to reckon with the fact that they have biological children who are going to attempt to find them.
Do you then have, I'm searching for the words. Do you then, your biological father has children? Do they feel like, what do they feel like to you? Siblings, cousins, friends of friends?
Yeah, it's all like brand new territory for all of us. And I'll also say was it Eric?
Yeah.
That I believe that my biological father feels very much the way that you do, that his family is his family. I don't believe I feel like family to him. He has a certain amount of pride in my accomplishments and interest and kind of a benign interest in it. I think his wife of 50 years, who he had never mentioned that he had donated sperm to because he simply didn't think that it was a big deal, she wasn't so thrilled.
Yeah.
And I think that was difficult for her because she thought, well, I know all of the children in the world who are my husband's and mine, and suddenly there's this other person out there who is also my husband's biological child. That wasn't easy, but going back to what I said before about everybody doing the right thing, I think that, you know, whether it's, I've become friends with my half-sister, his oldest daughter, who he raised. Right. Does she feel like my sister? I feel sisterly toward her, but we have a lot in common. He has two sons who I don't have as much in common with, and we're not particularly, we know about each other, and I've met one of them, but we're not particularly in each other's lives. My son has met my biological half-sister's kids, they're cousins. They share a biological grandfather. Mm-hmm. It's actually not strange. It's quite beautiful. But it doesn't feel that it takes away in any way from the family that is his family. I don't feel like they should be inviting me over for Christmas.
Right. We're going to leave it on that note. Do you have another memoir in you, by the way, Danny Shaviro?
I think I'm done, Marty.
with your memoir writing. Well, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for coming in and joining us today.
I so enjoyed it. Thank you.
Us as well. And the book is called Inheritance, A Memoir of Genealogy, Paternity, and Love. And again, our guest has been Danny Shaviro. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, sign up for our Facebook group page, and you can also check us out on Twitter as well. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen, with assistance today from Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.